We've been this summer reading passages in worship from the Old Testament prophets, and you'll see why the prophet Hosea doesn't exactly lend himself to children's sermons. So we're really glad that we heard from our Trinium folks for that moment today. But this, as I said, is kind of a difficult text, but I invite you to bear with me and listen for God's wisdom and word. As I say often, we will go somewhere with this. When the Lord first spoke through Hosea, the Lord said to him, "Go, marry a prostitute, and have children of prostitution. For the people of the land commit great prostitution by deserting the Lord." So Hosea went and took Gomer, Diblaim's daughter, and she became pregnant and bore him a son. And the Lord said to him, "Name him Jezreel, for in a while I will punish the house of Jehu for the blood of Jezreel, and I will destroy the kingdom of the house of Israel. And on that day I will break the bow of Israel in the Jezreel Valley." Gomer became pregnant again and gave birth to a daughter. And then the Lord said to Hosea, "Name her No Compassion, because I will no longer have compassion on the house of Israel or forgive them. But I will have compassion on the house of Judah, for I, the Lord their God, will save them. And I will not save them by a bow or by sword or by war or by horses or by horsemen." When Gomer finished nursing No Compassion, her daughter, she became pregnant and gave birth to another son. And then the Lord said, "Name him Not My People, because you are not my people and I am not your God." Yet the number of the people of Israel will be like the sand of the sea, which can be neither measured nor numbered. And in the place where it is said to them, "You are not my people," it will be said to them, "Children of the living God." This is holy wisdom, holy word. Thanks be to God. Someone in our midweek manna gathering, which happens in the chapel on Wednesdays, read this passage ahead of time and asked if I was being divinely punished for something. No, I said, but I feel like having to preach this feels like I committed a sin in a past life. Since earlier in the summer, I declared a commitment. I said, I'm going to preach the tough passages of the Old Testament. And so the lectionary, I think, tried to test me. And sometimes what the calendar does, it offers an alternative Old Testament reading or an alternate reading if the first one doesn't quite match the gospel text for the day, because in some churches they read all four of the texts. And the alternative to this one today was the story of Sodom and Gomorrah. So this was going to be awkward either way you shake it. And it reminded me of the time that a guest preacher came to St. Mark's and was at the former 8:30 service and was going to read a challenging passage. And somebody in the service said, "Well, can't we just read Matthew 25 instead?" No, we can't. But trust me, it's definitely tempting to pick up something that's a little more obviously uplifting and inspiring and positive, something that's easier on the ears. But for me, that kind of feels like cheating, or at least it's shortchanging the ways that God's Spirit has a way of consistently sprouting something from the dirt. And we as the church, have to wrestle with these messy parts of Scripture for several reasons. One, it's our heritage. As a global faith community, as a tradition, whether we like it or not, it's in our book. Two, people over the centuries have sacrificed a lot to get this book in our hands, and they saw something in here enough to preserve these texts. And three, I think the Spirit speaks through all this complexity and all this strange stuff if we're willing to listen. And to me, I approach a lot of Scripture kind of like Jacob wrestling with the angel, "I will not let you go until you bless me." So let's wrestle with Hosea here. A few things to ponder. One, obviously, this is a pretty troubling text. Its language is harsh, And let me be the first to say it is completely unacceptable to speak this way about women. Hands down. And when we read stuff like this, we can't let our holy writ off the hook. We have to say what's true. And what's true is this is some nasty stuff. And it was acceptable in Hosea's culture to use language like that, but that does not mean that it's acceptable in our day and time. I mean, I can only imagine how through the ages, men have read this text and have used it to justify all sorts of gender-based violence and patriarchal ideas. Not just this chapter, but in the whole book, there mentions the word that this version translated as prostitution 20 times. Other versions read promiscuous woman or harlot or some other words I'm not going to say. And this is not okay. Point number two. Good news for you. Hosea's wife and those unfortunately named children are not real people. They are literary devices that this fiery prophet uses to express God's displeasure with Israel. And he uses this metaphor of a human marriage to describe kind of how personal, how intimate is God's relationship with God's people. And the prophets do this in the Old Testament. They use these metaphors that are extreme and provocative to express God's seething, white, hot anger at being betrayed. Third thing to think about. Prophets, in that day and time, weren't really fortune tellers. We kind of treat them like they are. They're more like social critics. And as such, they were more concerned with the affairs of the day. Concerned puts it lightly. That's kind of a sterile word. Prophets were passionately inflamed with what we call politics, war, economics, all of that. And it wasn't in separate spheres, but all part of this one national life that was under the domain of God's will and God's ways. And the prophets saw Yahweh as intimately involved in the affairs of the day. There wasn't this church and state stuff. That's a later idea. But God was very much invested in what was happening with the northern kingdom of Israel and the southern kingdom of Judah and all the empires that swirled menacingly around them. God was very much concerned with the way that these people as a collective were wayward. Which brings me to four. Hosea's central message, which is that Israel is unfaithful to God, deeply, deeply unfaithful, wantingly unfaithful. And God is livid. As Rabbi Heschel, who is a prominent Jewish theologian of the 20th century and civil rights activist, he put it like this. To the prophet, God does not reveal, and I'm going to toy with the language here, God does not reveal herself in abstract absoluteness, but in personal and intimate relation to the world. God does not simply command and then just expect obedience. God is also moved and affected by what happens in the world and then reacts accordingly. Events and human actions affect in God joy or sorrow or pleasure or wrath, and she is not conceived as judging the world in some detachment. God reacts in an intimate and a subjective manner and thus determines the value of events. This notion that God can be intimately affected, that he possesses not merely intelligence and will, but pathos. Basically, that defines the prophetic consciousness. In other words, in my words, it means that God's got some skin in the game. God has a stake in what human beings do to one another. Whether they do justice or love mercy or whether they share abundantly what they have. This isn't sort of the God of Greek philosophy, but of abstract philosophical categories, but the loving creator of heaven and earth that is down in the dirt with creation. Put another simple way, what Hosea is trying to say is God cares. God cares enough about the evil in the world to condemn it. God cares that at Jezreel, that's one of the prophet's kids' names, Jehu, the king of king of Israel that Hosea mentions, that he assassinated the entire royal family in a really brutal way, and their relatives. God cares. God cares, Hosea says, that the northern kingdom is paying tribute to the Assyrians, an evil empire of sorts, because the Assyrians did what all empires do, and that's exploit and extract and enslave, kill. God cares. God cares that Israel worships other gods, those gods of fertility and agriculture, because what those gods demanded in return for their favor was some vile sacrifice. Instead of what Yahweh demands, and that is justice, love, peace, and mercy. You see, the God of Israel was a God of justice, and when the nation sort of got off-center in how it worshiped, bad things happened from there. So let me ask you, does God care now? Is God's pathos, is God's suffering and anger inflamed now? I mean, is God's heart broken now, these days, with this country, with this kingdom, with the wider global human community and how we treat one another, how we treat the earth itself? Does God care? That's not rhetorical, by the way. I mean, I think the obvious answer to this is a resounding yes. I mean, God cares. I mean, cataloging the things that are happening these days, I asked someone this morning, I said, what's the worst thing that is happening in America right now? And she said, the list is too long. Really? I mean, we got the border. Good gosh. People carrying around their documents on them in this Gestapo state. God cares of what's happening in Puerto Rico. God cares what is happening with our public schools. God cares what happens with people who don't have health insurance. God cares. And we could be here all day listing these things that God cares about because, you know, we live in community with other people. We know how we treat one another. We watch the news. We know. But as terrible as this text sounds, did you notice that sudden about face at the end? Those kids, those poor kids, Jezreel, no compassion, not my people, they get renamed. They get renamed children of the living God. You see, the other truth that Hosea is trying to get across to us, albeit in some pretty thorny ways, is that God absolutely refuses to give up on the relationship. As broken as God's heart is, as unfaithful as God's people can be, God does not give up. And there is this tension within the divine heart between anger and compassion. It's tumultuous conflict within the heart of God that the prophets bear out to us. But compassion wins in the end. There is a wideness in God's mercy. God's despair, God's constant disappointment at what people do to one another yields to hope. God has hope in us for redemption. God will not give up on the family. And I think that's this morning, that's the good news for us in the midst of so much bad news. That certainly, though angry as our God is, as brokenhearted as God is, God has not given up on this world. Oh man, it's tempting to believe that. Oh my gosh. But it's not true. How do you know that, Bart? As Mr. Rogers famously said in a TV interview, he said, my mother used to say a long time ago, whenever there'd be this real catastrophe in the news or on the air, she would say, always look for the helpers. There will always be helpers. You know, just on the sidelines, anybody who is coming to a place where there is tragedy, because if you look for the helpers, you will know that there is hope. Or as my friend Jacqueline, who's a leader in Border Angels, they're like the No More Deaths of the San Diego area. I walked the migrant trail with a couple of those folks, and she posted this the other day. Look around you. For if you pay attention to the right places, people are acting together in glorious ways to try to alleviate suffering. Find the people doing the work, she says, and go join them. The rest is really noise. God has not given up. God sends these prophets. God sends these imperfect, sometimes ornery people to tell an unvarnished truth. And God sends prophets. Prophets with a word of hope, too. God sends helpers into these tragedies, into these catastrophes. God sends you and me into this world that, yes, it angers God. Yes, it breaks God's heart. But we can go into that word, into that world fearlessly because we know who we are. We know our names. Children of the living God. May it be so.
That's what I think I taped it for 16 minutes instead of.